I then had to work it out myself. People have said over and over again, give me a book that does this. There wasn't one until I wrote the little booklet that covered it in all its... You want me to continue? It's station break time. Get on the telephone. G. Campbell Morgan and Epiphany. The rock on which he built his faith. The consciousness of myself and the universe became the conviction of God. In short, one day, standing on this earth, thinking of himself and being conscious of himself and the universe, he came to the point it was easier to believe there was a God than to doubt. Good for him. My dad never understood my doubts. He never did. Many of you are still here who've heard him tell his testimony. Converted in the old First Assembly of God Church in Oroville, a deacon on the board, felt the urge and the call to preach. Didn't think he was qualified. I came home one night, or he came home one night, went to bed. I was awakened to see Dad in unbearable pain, holding two kitchen chairs by their backs as he was trying to walk and could not stand up without the help of the chairs. And that began a bout with rheumatic fever. In those days, wasn't as well known. The disease went through the rest of his body. As he described it, ultimately to hit him in a terrible pain in the back of the neck. There were weeks of sickness that led to this. My mother was pregnant with what would be twin babies. This was the end of the Depression years. My dad went into a coma. For days, weeks, we watched him waste away. That's why I like to play Dad, 84, healthy, leading the singing in the church. In that coma, having wasted down from 180 pounds to about 125 or 30, in a coma, Dad had a vision. He saw the roof roll back. He saw what appeared to him in the vision to be balconies in the sky, and he saw his mother there waving him on into heaven. He felt himself lift out of his body. And he heard himself saying, "Lord, I'm ready to go. But what about my wife and boy? I hate to leave them." And then that vision of heaven disappeared, and he saw the great lighted Broadway. And people tripping along, singing, having a wonderful time. But the end of it was darkness, and he saw grotesque demons chained on each side of that Broadway, where it disappeared into abrupt darkness, and they were grabbing the people at the end of that Broadway, hurling them into it, We heard screams and cries of agony. And said as he was experiencing that, God, get me away from this before I lose my mind. Then the scene changed and he saw himself well and healthy, walking up a narrow path with a Bible under his arm. And he was conscious of being with someone he thought was the Lord, and he said, Lord, there I go. Well and healthy, what's this mean? And the one that was with him spoke and said, preach my word, and I'll heal you. We weren't part of the vision, but I still remember as a boy. The pastor was praying at the foot of the bed. My mother was not physically well herself and crying. And on our side, we thought Dad was gone. He sat straight up in the bed, looked at my mother and said, honey, I'll be preaching in 6 months or 6 weeks. I don't remember, one or the other. That's why, as his son, when Dad would sort of want to take it easy, I would say, Dad, you got to keep hanging in there with me because that's what keeps you alive. The doctors all said when rheumatic fever reached the stage it reached with him, he would die with a heart attack. All the doctors died long before Dad. And he was the picture of health that last Sunday, singing, He Set Me Free. God kept His word. But as much as I love Dad, and everybody knows that, and God, I wish He's here now, so I could talk to Him about what I'm facing. As much as I loved him, I envied him. God didn't do that for me. And my dad could never understand my doubts. He didn't have any. He didn't just have a little rock for his foot, he had bedrock. Yet I tell you the truth. Once I got my face straightened out, heaven knows there were plenty of times that it's my faith that took us through when Dad and I were slugging it out with the devil in our ministry when I first was his associate and then he mine. Because my faith was on even more sure ground. Every time he had a pain, his faith was attacked. If he didn't stay healed, the devil was there to question. Me, I doubt everything. But I smash it against that stone that was rolled away. He came out of that tomb. I know it because I've looked at the evidence. And I said today to someone I talked to, what you've heard me say over and over again, not once in my entire life have I found a man, from professors who shook my faith to people on the street, not once have I found a man that doubts the resurrection of Jesus Christ, but what I can ask him 15 questions and know he hasn't spent 15 hours looking at the evidence. But that's my message next Easter. I'm saying to those that don't have epiphanies, there's a better way. a hard, cold look at the one sign that God deigned to give of His reality and the revelation of His nature in Christ. So you don't have to have an epiphany, but you do got to have some rock to put your foot down on. And I remember the time I was state inspector in a peach cannery. My job was to, in the summer months as I was going to college, my job was to be a state inspector. I was a bureaucrat once. God's got to forgive me a lot of sins, but that one must top them all. And I sat in that office with a foul-mouthed yard boss that I wish I could meet again, because I've learned to cuss better than him. I'd teach him something. He was angry at me all the time because I only had to work 5 minutes out of every hour. That's all I had to do. Go out and watch him dump peaches in the dump truck to make sure they threw them away and didn't give them to some poor hungry person under the quota systems of production, where a certain percentage had to be slopped. So I was there to see to it that the management of the cannery didn't make under the table profits or goodwill by giving away that which the law required that they destroy. So all I had to do is go out and watch them dump barrels for 5 minutes, go back into this little office and sit down in a rocking chair and study a different set of books every day at work on the resurrection. And I remember the day I closed the last book and said, "There's no other answer." He came out of that tomb. Now, what am I going to do about it? Let the claims that he made speak to me as an individual and start acting on them. Now, that's how I came to it. But back to G. Campbell Morgan. Now, I should like to describe the process by which the conviction came. Told you mine, now we're back to Morgan. "That is not easy, but I propose to attempt it with all brevity. That conviction, namely, it's easier in the presence of myself and the universe to believe that there is a God than to believe that there is not. That conviction came as the result of a look back, a look around, and a look on." Okay? "A look back to origins, I came to realize that everything results, and to ask from what? You remember Mr. Hastings' old riddle, here's a hen, here's an egg. The hen results from what? The egg. The egg results from what? The hen. Go on, and when you have solved that, you have solved the Christian religion. I only quote to remind you that everything results. A chair? It results from what? From man's handiwork. On what? Trees. How did they come? They resulted. From what? Leather. What is that? There were animals once. Whence came they? They resulted. From what? Get on back with your journey. That is all very childish, is it not? But put your hand where you will, put it on your own thin veined wrist. It results from what? All that is the beginning of a journey. I do not care how far back you go through the long centuries, the infinite mysteries, all the evolutionary processes. I do not care anything about them. Back. Oh, where did it all begin? The only answer that ever brought satisfaction to my soul, and I've underlined that in this book, to my soul, Campbell speaking, is, quote, in the beginning, God. Yes, I can believe that. If you say mighty Adam, or tell me about protoplasmic germ, which John Ruskin translates for me and reminds me that the Greek term means first stuck together, I ask, what was stuck together? And who stuck it together? I'm not playing. My soul went through all this in agony 25 years ago, and no theory satisfied my reason until I said, at the back of all results as originating cause is God. That was my first bit of rock. Well, wonderful for him. Didn't work for me. That's the age-old argument for God, the first cause. But you see, I got a funny brain. Infinite regression without a beginning is no harder for me to believe or doubt than first cause. From my viewpoint, even today, there's no logical necessity for a first cause. To some people, there has to be. Furthermore, I've had enough philosophic training to know you can't even prove any of these things exist that he's talking about resulting. All you can prove is relationships. You describe any of it, extend it through scientific instruments. You cannot tell me anything about anything, including this book, including me, including that camera, including your television set. You cannot tell me anything about it that I cannot respond. You've just told me a relationship you're having with it. It's solid. It's hard. It's heavy. It tastes. It smells. It refracts light. Go on down to atoms going around. All you're going to be able to tell me is a relationship you're having with that thing, whatever it is. That's why the philosopher in the idealist frame says, is there a sound in the woods when there's nobody there to hear it? And our realistic frame, conditioned by our language that fixes our frame of reference before we even know it. So that's a stupid question. Anybody knows sound's there. And you throw up your hands and say, okay, all I can tell you about this thing, whatever it is relationships, but there's something there, and I'm here, and we're having those relationships. You can't prove that. You assume it. And the Western world finds it easy to assume that because our whole language frame, the verbs change, the nouns and pronouns essentially stay the same. Subject and object are not changed by the action. But there are languages in the world where you change the verb action, the nouns change also. And if you grow up in that language frame, you find it easier to be what in epistemology we call an idealist. The idealist says, since nothing can be found or described, encountered or experienced other than relationships, that's all there is. Just a sea of relationships. By the way, that's the philosophy that progressive education is built on. That's why they say there's no absolute truth. Most of the teachers that teach it don't know the philosophy, but that's John Dewey's experimentalism. Out of idealism and epistemology, which is theory of knowing, what can be known? Nothing but relationships. Therefore, there are no absolutes. There is no absolute other than the absolute. There's no absolute. Everything changes except the one fact that everything changes. There are no absolute truths. There are no permanent values. There is no individual immortality. Indeed, there's no such thing as individuality. We're just a foci of relationships. It affects everything you do, how you pray, and God becomes the totality of those relationships. So you don't have a first cause, you have an ongoing relationship. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
So I'm sorry. If E. Campbell Morgan lived in a more cloistered day when a first cause was a logical starting point for a belief in God. I don't care what your epistemology is. When a foci comes swinging along making the claims that Jesus foci made and comes out of the tomb 3 days later, contrary to all relationships against that, And I'm looking at him. But God happened to send his word in the fullness of time when a language frame existed, the Greek language like ours, where realism is assumed. There are entities having relationships, but you can't prove that. It's assumed. I have more than an assumption. Once I accept the resurrection of Christ and his authority, he preached a message of realism. Prayer to the idealists and to those that say nothing exists but relationships, you find God by getting out of the relation, beyond it, nirvana. Get out of the wheel of life. You find God inside in a trance-like condition where you lose any sense of individual identity. But to the realist and to the Christian frame, the highest form of communication between God and man, and I'm ahead of the story, is a dialogue, a person talking to another person. And whatever else God may be, he's not me. He's the great other, and I'm other than him. And you're other than me. And we have an immortal existence, one of two places. But I'm ahead of the story. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
They're on telephone. First cause, not required. Doesn't do a thing for my faith. Thank God it shored up as the first rock in the foundation of his faith for G. Campbell Morgan. And maybe you are so constituted in your person that you have to have a first cause. Even that doesn't lead you to a personal God. I remember Canon Brian Green skipped over the resurrection and started immediately with the premise before he tackled what we have to do with God. That you have to assume that ultimate reality is personal. And that didn't do a thing for me because I didn't have to assume that. And if God's personal, then it's the nature of a person to communicate. And we communicate by words, even in sign language, symbols. So you expect God to communicate, and you look for his message. And it's there in the heavens. It's in his word, through mouths of prophets and seers. And his fullest message was spoken through a person who came to tell us, the eternal word, who could tell us all that we need to know about God in a tent of flesh, and the eternal word became the spoken word. But I can't start with that. I started with the resurrection. And the one who rose said, all authority in heaven and earth seated in him. The resurrection stamped him with his authority, and then my faith built backward from him. He's the one that taught me about a creator. He's the one that used the books as ordained from God that say, in the beginning, God. I couldn't start there. He revealed God, saying, you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And he was a person who brought a word to us. But back to Campbell. That was my first bit of rock. First cause. Then there was a look around. That was the look back. First on the vast, then on the minute, on the far-flung splendors of the starry night, on the minutiae of beauty and a handful of lichen, of moss, of dust. I looked out on life, not on human life merely, but on all life, and I saw changeless change and changing changelessness, seasons regularly moving, life repeating itself true to type, types by inoculation, with new types making new mysteries and new wonders, but everywhere order and everywhere law. I said, who presides over all this? A double-faced something? Nothing? It all happened? I can't believe that. Then I found that the Christian writings declare of man the final manifestation of life. In God he lives and moves and has his being. I came to see that the infinitely great God, is seen in the infinitely little thing in the dust and in the infinitely vast thing, the universe. And I said, yes, that is easier than any other proposition to explain it. Not for me. Thank God that that's the argument of order, that this there had to be a first causer. I don't think there has to be. Perpetual, infinite regression, no problem. The whole is as important as the part. The ongoing is easy to believe as the beginning. The second proposition, again, is as old as apologetics, the arguments for the Christian faith, all of which seeks, to avoid the hard, tough question, can you rest your faith on the resurrection? Now, he's right, he's on safe ground. Paul says all men are without excuse. God wrote his message in the stars, and this is the argument of order. That the intricacy of the universe from the vast to the minute could not have come about by chance, that something is ordering this constantly moving, infinitely vast, mathematically perfect universe on top of universe, galaxy on top of galaxy, not by chance. And man, the highest being in the whole universe, cannot be just a product of evolution. Well, I find evolution harder to believe in regard to man. So something in my psyche can't buy that missing link jump. But the order of the universe does not require a belief in God for me. That wouldn't do it for me. But the one who came out of the tomb tells me who orders it. And on that basis, I can make sense of the universe because of the authoritative view I accept, the one who proved his point of view by victory over death. And sailing off into that ordered universe, saying he would come back. But you got to start somewhere. Morgan could start on these grounds. I insist most people don't have the guts to base their faith on the solidest rock. I still remember Lex Miller, who directed the religious side of my doctoral dissertation at Stanford. New Zealand ethical theologian, studied under Karl Barth in Germany, Niebuhr's assistant at Union. I said to him one day, Lex, and we became quite close toward the end as I finished my dissertation with him. He said to me concerning Reinhold Niebuhr, he says, Gene, you know more about what Reinie has said in his writings than Reinie does himself. He begged me not to go back into the Assemblies of God in those days. It took me a long, circuitous route to see that he was right. By the way, I was not kicked out of any denomination. I graduated in my own growth. But in those days, when I came out of Stanford, I took literal the verse that Paul said, when you're called, remain in the place you're called, and I felt I had a debt to owe to the denomination of my childhood, and as I returned to faith, I gave it my best, and I think provided great service to the Assemblies of God. Research director of their committee on advance that rewrote their theology and charted the course that made them the fastest growing denomination in America. Wrote the taxonomy and directed the transfer of leadership from their 86 schools overseas from nationals to missionaries. Headed the Blue Ribbon Committee that put Evangel College back on the track of serving the purposes for which it was created. And with Herb Ellingwood, the legal secretary of Governor Reagan, co-chaired the Blue Ribbon Committee for the Northern California-Nevada District after the research director of the Committee on Advance that did it for the whole denomination, that charted the course for the Northern California-Nevada District of the Assemblies of God, which is why their retired superintendent, who used to travel with me in various seminars, like a rejected lover, said to the Times I was such a waste that I wasn't with them anymore. I came to the conclusion God wanted me free. But Lex Millard said it to me at Stanford. He said, Gene, he begged me with tears running down his cheeks, don't go back in the Assemblies of God. They'll resent you. They'll constantly force you to prove your spirituality because of a widespread attitude against education at that time. And he said, in all the years I've taught, you are the only truly creative theologian I've ever had as a student. Let me book you in various seminars, and much the path that Canon Brian Green was following. But I went back to the Assemblies. But I said to him, Lex, why is it that you build your faith on the beauty and perfection of Jesus, and you're not willing to base it on the resurrection? And you're quite willing to say, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, but you're not willing to base your faith on the resurrection. He said, Gene, I'm so afraid that if I make that the basis, I won't be able to convince myself that he came out of the tomb, and then I'll have to ditch the rest of it. Well, Paul said, if there's no resurrection, our faith is vain. Furthermore, we're false witnesses of God, for we have declared that God raised him up from the dead. Paul made the resurrection the cornerstone, the fulcrum, the crux of it all, because it is. Without the resurrection, Christianity is a lie. I remember when Dr. Kishimoto, who came from University of Tokyo to study religion 5 years here on a grant, he took Anasaki's place as the leading Buddhist scholar in the Far East. And he came to Union, to Yale, to Harvard, to Princeton, and to Stanford. And Stanford was the fifth year, and I took his comparative religion class. And by then I was getting my faith straightened out. And he tried to compare developing Christology, which is a belief in Christ as God, to developing Buddhology, belief that Buddha is God. And I remember writing the paper eventually, not advised to most undergraduates, but this was a graduate course, in which I challenged it. I said, I can plot through the Sanghitas. Every 200 years, the followers of Buddha met in special sessions to consider their master's teachings. And in the tripart basket of scriptures from which Buddhism, both North and South, grows, you have Buddha's own sermons. He was a prince in India after he raised his family, beset with what they call tanya, a sense of thirst for the things of this world. He tried to rid himself of it first by satiation, by throwing himself into sensuality. That didn't work. He then followed the way of the yogi and the Vedanta faith of denial of the reality of the things of this world, and he reached what he called the middle path, the Eightfold Path, where he went into a trance-like state and was delivered from his attachments to this world and attained the temporary nirvana of touching ultimate reality that would take him out of the wheel of life and the force of karma. And when he died, he'd become one with the ultimate that behind all that. But his sermons say to his disciples that his death means nothing. that he's nothing. All he leaves them is the way. And every 200 years you plot his disciples looking back at the Buddha, and they then conclude about 600 years down the road that he could not have said and done the things that he said and did if he were not divine. So they stamp theology, they stamp divinity back on him. The first message of the Christian church is a miracle claim. He is risen. It is not some conclusion of later followers. From the earliest hymns of the church, those bodies within the Gospels that represent the oral tradition, the earliest message, he rose. Without the resurrection, he died a martyred fool. There's no stamping of divinity at a later date. There is a later date attempt to demythologize the earliest message. But from the beginning, they proclaim the miracle, resurrection, and ascension, and the empty tomb. So, as a result, I give Dr. Kishimoto credit. He invited me into a year of individual study where he presented the claims of, or I presented the claims of Christ against his knowledge in the backdrop of Oriental religions. The Vedanta faith, particularly in the various strands of Buddhism that grew out of it. I'm telling you, the Christian faith will stand the test of the resurrection. But Lex Miller said he didn't have the courage for fear it might upset the apple cart of a faith he'd given his life to. If somebody can come in and knock the resurrection underpinnings out from under my faith. I'm 65, but I can still cut a pretty good path of sin. And plenty of things I'm going to do. I'm hooked on that fact of the resurrection. What got Campbell wouldn't get me. Then I look on, back to Campbell, all the mystery. The light is not clear even yet, but the rhythmic order of things convinced me that at the last, that cannot end worst, which begin best. There is a goal somewhere to be reached somehow, one far-off divine event to which the whole creation moves. I am not talking theology now. Theology discusses how the goal is to be reached. No, I'm not right. The conviction, it does both. The conviction of the goal brought certainty in my own soul of the one presiding being. Well, God got him easier than he got me. Got my dad easier after he made him sick. I don't need to. Nothing in the universe tells me there has to be a goal. Jesus tells me there's a goal. What shall it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? Don't fear him that can destroy the body, but rather fear him that can destroy both soul and body in hell. And his great revelatory spokesperson, Paul, outlines how that God's master creation will fill that gap left by Satan and his angels when they were cast out, a third of heaven. And we will be put on display to the eons to come as God's greatest creative accomplishment. But I learned that from the Word that established itself through the resurrection. I'm not done with this. I'm going to continue. Get on telephone.